to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. With Republicans controlling the White House, Congress, and many state legislatures, women's rights are under assault more than at any time in the modern women's movement. Progress made through hard work over 50 years is in danger of being rolled back. Issues central to women's well-being are in jeopardy, including protection from sexual harassment and violence, access to health care, and access to safe legal abortion. Just this week, Republicans in Congress tried to ram through a health care bill that would drastically cut health care for women, children, low-income people, seniors, including many in nursing homes, and the disabled, while shockingly using the savings to lavish more tax cuts for the rich. The Congressional Budget Office says the bill would push 22 million people off of health care insurance, and people would die so millionaires and billionaires can enjoy more tax breaks. Organizers mobilized enough of an outcry to delay the vote, but Republicans are pushing to vote on the bill after the July 4th recess, and there is a danger this horrendous bill could actually pass. Our guest today is working to defend women's rights and protect programs important to our well-being. Heidi Sayek is co-founder and CEO of Vote Pro Choice. Heidi is a civic entrepreneur with 25 years' experience in innovation and activism, with a passion for elevating women to positions of leadership. She also serves as chair of the National Institute for Reproductive Health Board of Directors, as an advisory board member of Vote Run Lead, and on the founding board of directors of Emerge New York. Heidi Sayek, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here and having this conversation.
Yes, it's a critical conversation at a critical moment, so I'm thrilled you're here to talk with us. Let's begin, if you could please explain to our listeners, what is Vote Pro Choice that you're working on?
Vote Pro Choice is a radically inclusive nationwide political action platform that connects pro-choice voters with pro-choice candidates in strategic down-ballot races. Now, why this is so important is that we look at every election in the country, from Congress to the school board, evaluate the strategic races, and support great pro-choice candidates who might not otherwise get support from political parties or other organizations. Now, I will admit, we are actually we were started as an experimental project of Democrats.com. In the 2016 election, we wanted to aggregate information about down-ballot candidates, particularly the endorsements of all of the pro-choice organizations, and we served as a ballot guide in the 2016 elections. We had suspected that we would be able to close up shop and perhaps bring the ballot guide back in 2018 for the congressional races. We never thought that the presidential election would turn out the way it did. And so in the wake of this unbelievable political transformation, which is how I like to see it, we realized the importance of our mission and recommitted to the vision and reorganized ourselves to be able to look at these down-ballot races in a new way. So we find these great candidates in various strategic races. We evaluate the other partnerships that are in those races. So, for example, one of our candidates is Jennifer Carroll Foy, who is running in District 2 of the House of Delegates in Virginia in a primary. None of the other major organizations had endorsed her or were supporting her campaign, but she was a wonderful pro-choice woman of color, a public defender, a foster parent. She had a great story. She was a clear advocate and leader. So we went in and helped her race, and she ended up winning her primary by 12 votes. So we engage partners. We focus on the candidates and the campaigns and what they need. And then finally, we also will be doing a ballot guide again this year, so all folks and voters will know who the pro-choice candidates are in all of their elections.
Okay, great. So for our listeners who aren't steeped in political action, when you say you're connecting pro-choice voters with pro-choice candidates in down-ballot races, you mean by down-ballot the races that are not, say, U.S. Congress or maybe statewide, is that right?
That's right. We do focus on some statewide elections, but really, most of the political focus of our news media and the attention that we're directing all of our attention on this presidential issue we've got here, as well as our congressional issues. And really, there's just so much important, incredible work and opportunities for leadership in races that start with governor, but also our state legislative races, city council races, mayors, public defenders, city attorneys, county clerks, all the way down to school board elections. These all have deep and significant impact on the issue of reproductive choice in America.
I'm so happy
that
you
don't get as much attention.
Right. No, exactly right. And I'm so happy you're giving attention in that area, because really in a presidential election year, the presidential race sucks up about 90% of the attention this past year, maybe even more, given how crazy it was, exciting in a very weird kind of way. But there are huge numbers of races beyond that and even beyond the congressional races. So I'm so happy that you're giving attention to them. Now, how exactly do you discover, how do you know who's pro-choice in terms of the voters?
Well, we actually focus on the candidates, and our goal mm-hmm. is to provide information to voters about the position of the candidates. And this is where it becomes really critically important, because I should say, and we use the concept of pro-choice with a really broad lens, meaning that a person believes that a woman should have access to abortion services, reproductive health care services, that's safe, legal, accessible, without shame. And that also includes not just women, but transgender men and reproductive health access for everyone. We are radically inclusive. So what that means is a very, very broad. And what we do is we use the partnerships that we have with other organizations like Planned Parenthood and NARAL Pro-Choice America, as well as other progressive organizations like Move On, Indivisible, Democracy for America, the Women's March, like many, many other organizations in which we are in partnership. We try to discover great candidates who are out there, both through outreach as well as partnerships. And we evaluate them, and we ask them questions about their perspectives on reproductive health access, as well as some other economic issues, which we can talk about in a minute. And then we evaluate whether they're going to be really active leaders in carrying a policy perspective that supports reproductive health care access. We determine the strategic impact of the race. So if this is a person running against an anti-choice candidate or a state legislative race that could potentially flip a state legislature to be supportive of pro-choice agenda, and then we will evaluate that candidate, and we ask that they sign a pledge that says, yes, they will support access for all people to reproductive health care services, and they will actively be a leader in advancing that agenda. And then we do whatever we can to help them get elected.
Well, that's fantastic. And, we talked about how some of these major races of the presidency and then even the congressional races get a fair amount of attention. But there are actually 520,000 elected offices mm-hmm. in the United States. Most of those are local, and most of those get absolutely zero attention. So it's very hard to know if you're a voter unless you live and breathe politics. It's hard to know what are the races and who are the candidates and what about their background, because they're not being covered. Mm-hmm. And we have fewer and fewer newspapers, which used to be reliable for the local papers to cover it. Now a lot of the local newspapers have gone out of business. So it's gotten actually oddly harder and harder to get information about these, as you call them, down ballot or more local races. So it's really important that you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, that's where our ballot guide is so important, as well as partnerships. We really do emphasize that. Planned Parenthood and NARAL Pro-Choice America have been incredible leaders in the area of protecting reproductive health care services and political action. But we all have to step back and admit that we've been losing a lot of ground. And so the way we see it is we are here to help and support and find more pro-choice voters and provide information to those voters so that they're able to vote with a perspective of a pro-choice perspective to support the work of Planned Parenthood and NARAL Pro-Choice America. And that ballot guide is so important because it does show all of the down ballot races in every race in the country, all the way down to school board, although in some smaller areas in the United States, we don't have all of the school board races properly geolocated or located in the right districts. We're working on that right now. That's a technology challenge for us. But for towns that are roughly 10,000 people or more, we do have all the down ballot races available. And then what we do is we gather information from all the organizations about the endorsements that they have made in these races, so you can see the different positions of the candidates. And then we allow our ballot guide allows for people to submit information that they have about the candidates. So there's also a crowdsourcing capability. So folks that might know something about a candidate that we haven't found or we don't know, they can submit that information too. It's really critical, like you said, and it's a point that I definitely want to make here, which is we have discovered in our work and some innovative polling that 7 in 10 American voters, that's 70% of American voters, including Republicans and Democrats and independents, believe that a woman should have access to abortion, specifically abortion, that is safe, legal, accessible, affordable, and without shame, as well as available in her community. That is not currently the reality that we're facing in America. There is an incredible rollback of access and rights that a lot of voters don't know about. And what we have discovered, the polling shows us, or the focus groups have also showed us, that when you inform the voters of the situation in their states, as well as the perspective of the candidates, they are often shocked and horrified that they didn't know this, and they're ignited into action. So that is 7 in 10 American voters, 70% of American voters, will actually support and vote on the issue of reproductive health care access for all people.
Yeah, so you're talking about a really important point here about the rollback that's happening at the state level as the Republicans have gotten control of the state legislatures, that they've been really... you know, when they couldn't overturn the safe legal abortion with the Roe v. Wade decision of the Supreme Court, so they were working at the state level to just make it very hard for women to access the reproductive health care they need in order to be able to have a safe legal abortion. So tell us a little bit about that. Actually, the one person I know who's actually given a lot of attention, not a lot, but some attention on that issue is Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, did a whole series of wonderful shows on that. And also Samantha Bee, who does a great 30-minute kind of political comedy show. So the two of them have given some attention to it. But tell us some examples, like what is happening in some of the states? How are they chipping away at abortion rights, even though it's supposed to be legal, but they're making it very hard to access?
And this is key. I'm so glad we're going to have an opportunity to talk about this. Also, John Oliver did a wonderful piece as well.
Oh, good for him.
Add him to that list. He did a wonderful piece about a year or so ago about what's actually happening in the states. Ever since Roe v. Wade was decided and handed down from the Supreme Court in 1973, there has always been an attempt to restrict access to legal, safe abortion in the United States. However, in 1992, there was another Supreme Court decision that did allow the states a little more leeway to be able to impose restrictions on abortion services. And since then, I would say in the last 40 years since Roe v. Wade was handed down, thousands of bills have been introduced and many have been enacted. But since 1992, hundreds of bills have been enacted in the states that do limit access in various ways. And these could include everything from mandatory ultrasounds, waiting periods. Some states actually require doctors to provide medically inaccurate information to women who are seeking abortion services, such as, abortion can cause breast cancer, which is not true, but is a mandated script required by states. So there are little tiny hacks at these particular, in state access. This has caused abortion providers to not be able to provide service that's available and accessible. In addition, there are some bills that have passed that require abortion clinics to have a particular onerous types of regulations around the way that they're structured and built. That's also caused some clinics to close. And now, of course, we have the issue of Planned Parenthood funding taking away funding for those clinics. And in Iowa, I think that Planned Parenthood has actually closed a bunch of clinics. So what does this mean? It means that little by little, hack by hack, the access is removed. Even though Roe v. Wade is still in place, there has been a reduction in accessible and available reproductive health care services. And that's not just abortion services. It's everything from all the reproductive health care services, access to birth control, breast cancer screenings. It's a really impactful with regard to the health and well-being of women, particularly women who may not have the private insurance or financial resources to get to be able to travel for whatever services they need or to pay for private insurance. So this is a real serious issue. We found two things. One is women in states and women and men in states don't really understand the picture of this access issue in their states. And perhaps it's because the information about the different rollbacks are featured in disparate stories, or perhaps we as a reproductive rights movement haven't been communicating broadly enough. Perhaps there's other ways that we can get through the noise of the anti-choice language, all of this loud anti-choice fake news and stories that we see. It's really clouded the truth. And uh-huh. The key is when folks in the states hear the truth, they are horrified and they're ignited into action, like I said before. Uh-huh. The final point that I'll make is it is a very serious issue to lose Roe v. Wade, and we are certainly one retirement of the Supreme Court away, or hopefully Ruth Bader Ginsburg stays very, very healthy. That if we have another anti-choice Supreme Court justice, the rollback of Roe v. Wade is very serious. And what is happening in the states right now is that state legislatures that are anti-choice are attempting to pass legislation that unconstitutionally bans abortion, which puts the reproductive rights movement in a particular situation. Because if we appeal those enacted laws in the states, that means they will elevate into particular circuit courts and potentially to the Supreme Court. And depending on the timing, that means that we could potentially reach an anti-choice Supreme Court. If Roe v. Wade is removed from the United States of America, that means that the states have oversight of the regulations and access of abortion rights. This is where the work of the state legislatures become absolutely critical. And there is the reason why vote pro-choice exists and looks at these down-ballot races, because we must make sure that our state legislatures are filled with active pro-choice champions who are willing to make sure that the state regulations support access to reproductive health care services for everyone, so we can be ready if anything horrible happens at the national level.
Right. And just to follow up on that, you know, I'm sure our listeners know on the Supreme Court right now, we've had just barely a majority that would support keeping abortion safe and legal. But if just one of our pro-choice members of the Supreme Court vacates for any reason, like a retirement or illness or death, the current president and U.S. Senate is sure to put in another anti-choice justice who would overturn Roe v. Wade, which is what made abortion legal nationally. So that's it. And by the way, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's our champion on the court and been very strong for women's rights, both at Columbia Law School and now on the Supreme Court, we here in Washington, D.C. are doing everything we can to keep her healthy. There's people willing to bring her smoothies and health food and showing her how to do the plank and exercises to keep healthy.
We
are just one vote away on the Supreme Court from losing the abortion rights being legal nationwide. That is a very scary place to be.
It is very scary. And that's why I think we all need to take a moment and really focus on practical action. We are in a dire situation at the federal level. We just are. And that is a result of many things, including this terrible president and the Supreme Court makeup and this Congress. And we go back down one more level and we say, okay, we have this Congress because of the way that the congressional districts are drawn in the states, that we have all of these very conservative Congress people that are safe in their seats because their districts are structured in such a way that they can't ever be booted out of office. And then you go down one more level and you see the impact of really focusing on these state legislatures, governorships, mayors, and cities. That is where the work is these days. And we have to focus there. We just really must. Not only is it important from a policy and protection level, it has great impact on both this congressional district, redrawing their congressional districts, the policies that we need to put in place in the states to protect reproductive health care services. But it's also, these are the leaders of the future. And these, the folks that can be elected into state legislatures will become the future Congress people that we hope will be champions for us. And I also would like to give a bit of a perspective on a state legislative race, or even like a city council race, for example. You know, I want to use my words carefully. I was about to say not that difficult to get elected, but that's not necessarily true. But in local and state races, it is a very accessible path of service. That's what we're finding with our vote pro-choice candidates. We, for example, we just recently supported a new American city council person in Burlington, Vermont, a great pro-choice advocate, and his number of votes that he needed to win is, he's in a very conservative district. We wanted to make sure we had a pro-choice champion there. He was a great up-and-coming leader. He could win his race by 500 votes. We were able to go in and help him on some field, and he was able to get 650 votes. But he's a future congressperson in Vermont, or a future senator, or like Bernie Sanders, who's a senator in Vermont, potentially a future presidential candidate. So these are races that are completely, completely winnable by great candidates. And I just want to put a plug in out there for all of the hundreds and thousands of people, particularly women and women of color, who have stepped up since this election and the Women's March and said, I want to lead. I want to run. I just want to put a plug out there for both that call to service as well as what Vote Pro Choice does. Yes, please. And we are here to help you.
That's awesome. And, you know, I think part of it is that we've had now abortion being legal since, as you say, 1973 and the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision. So that's now like 44 years where it's been legal. And a lot of people haven't been alive or weren't really aware when abortion was illegal. And, you know, just to take a minute here to go, if we lose that right nationally, and actually we're seeing at the state level what that means in women's lives, you know, to go back to the days when abortion was illegal. It's actually a crime for a doctor to perform an abortion or for a woman to ask for one or receive one. And then we had, you know, the back alley illegal abortions, women dying because they weren't getting proper medical care and treatment, or women trying to induce abortion themselves with coat hangers and dying from bleeding. I mean, this is really very serious issue to lose it. And I think people have a hard time imagining that actually, yes, we can go back to those days and we can have it legal. Not only can we, but as you talked about in some of the states, it's already happening because the access to safe legal abortion has been more and more restricted. So it's as a practical matter, women are denied that right because they don't have access to a women's reproductive health clinic that will provide those services. So what you're talking about is essential for women to be able to be you know, really have the freedom to determine and chart our own lives, like how many children to have, when to have them, make sure we can have children, that we can take care of them, we can afford them, we can have the emotional and financial situation to be able to love and nourish and raise the children, you know, the 20 years it takes to grow a child. So it just, from a woman's point of view, having the right to choose whether to have a woman, to have a child or not, is absolutely fundamental to our freedom and sovereignty as individuals.
Mm-hmm. And I think we can elevate and discuss two points that you brought up that I believe are very critical. One is the risk of losing this constitutional right. There's two really scary perspectives that I've recently come across in my role on the board of the National Institute for Reproductive Health, which is an increased search online. Actually, Google has been reporting increased searches online of self-induced abortion. How do you do it?
Oh,
and
my God.
Really terrifying. And so we can actually see online search trends of this happening now. The second piece that's just really quite disturbing is that in some states, their abortion is still, the right to an abortion is in the criminal code, which means that it's either protected or it is prosecutable. And that means, first of all, that doctors may not have as much flexibility to perform the service in a state that doesn't necessarily have abortion in the health code versus the criminal code. So if we lose Roe v. Wade, that means that even in states like New York, where abortion is legal, it still sits in the criminal code. So there will be limitations on the types of services. For example, abortion after 20 weeks or 24 weeks, and in some cases, things like in vitro fertilization become a criminal act in theory. So additionally, in some states like Indiana, self-induced abortion is also in the criminal code, meaning that if a woman chooses to terminate a pregnancy, she can be put in jail. And there was a woman that was actually arrested and served in Indiana, served 6 months in jail because she chose to terminate a pregnancy on her own. And so that is a situation in the States I will point the listeners out to the National Institute of Reproductive Health website, just recently released a white paper that talked about the state of self-induction in our criminal codes and our codes across the country. But it's just another reason to really focus on what the policy frameworks are in our states. And again, I'll make another plug, why focusing on these state legislative races and city races are so important. So those are just two not such great news, but hopefully it'll focus people on some of the work that's happening in their own states, and they can determine the situation in their state legislatures.
Well, I think that's just so critical because, you know, we look here at what's happening in Congress, and it can seem like, you know, it's just a massive gridlock here, except for, you know, some of this terrible executive orders that the president has done, or now they've got this horrendous health care bill that would literally push people off of health care so they can give a tax break to people who are already very wealthy. I mean, it's just, it's like something out of Charles Dickens. It's shocking it's so bad. But people can feel helpless because you figure, well, you know, my congressperson's okay, but I can't control what these other ones have done, and the Republicans have done the gerrymandering to fortify them getting more seats in the House, even though the Democrats get more votes for members of the U.S. House. But we have a lot more influence at the state and city level, and you know, I recently been the past few years been focusing on the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and actually wrote this Mayor's Guide to Gender Equality, because I felt like it would be so hard to get anything through Congress. But mayors are executives, and they can take immediate action. And some of the mayors have just got just a crop of incredible, wonderful leaders, like Mitch Landau, who's now the head of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And so when we focus on the state and city level, you know, we can have more impact, and like you're talking about, we can actually run candidates and win them because you don't need as many votes to win a race there. So that's fantastic. You're focusing on this state and city level.
It's not, yes, and it's not, it doesn't take as much, that much money. In larger cities, of course it does, but you know, you can win a Vermont State House race for $1,200. You know, it all depends. I think what I want to emphasize for your listeners is a little bit of hope as well as possibility, which is we have to remember, again, going back to what I was talking about before, 7 in 10 American voters, Republicans, Democrats, believe a woman should have access to reproductive health care services. 7 in 10, 70%. Sometimes they don't actually relate to the term pro-choice. But when you actually ask them about, do they believe that this should be available, birth control, healthcare services, they say yes. So I want to remind us that we are actually the majority, and that we have been silenced or discouraged by this very, very loud, well-coordinated, and pretty scary vocal minority, as is often the case. But I want us to really focus and be clear that our perspectives are shared by Americans across the board, including red states and small towns and the South and Republicans. So that I think that's really something to think about and listen to our political news through that lens. And secondly, I want to talk touch a little bit upon the importance of those municipal races and city councils and mayors. There's two areas of reproductive health care services that we want to keep in mind, which is in the clinics and the healthcare clinics in local communities and cities. You want to make sure that you have a pro-choice city council and a pro-choice mayor who is willing to protect the property of those clinics, protect the women and transgender men who may want services from those clinics, which include work in the planning zones and buffer zones and also might be willing to ban certain aspects of crisis pregnancy centers. And for those of you who don't know, that there is a type of kind of a faux storefront clinic that's called a crisis pregnancy center that says that it provides pregnancy healthcare services and information if you're pregnant. They are 100% anti-choice clinics, and they provide medically inaccurate information. They often will distract women who want to terminate a pregnancy and have that freedom to choose. And it's really quite disturbing. So you want cities who are willing to put some regulations around the proliferation of these crisis pregnancy centers. The cities are often the largest employer in certain areas. I know my home is San Francisco. It's the largest employer in San Francisco. The city and county of San Francisco is. And a mayor who is willing to make sure that the city insurance policies have the insurance programs for city employees have a full range of reproductive health care services, birth control access, transgender health care services is really important and has a direct impact on the city, the civil servants who are providing service to the cities. So there's a lot of great protective work that we can do at the municipal level that will provide a buffer in the face of this horrible federal legislation.
Yeah, that sounds really good. So now you're doing this ballot guide, and it sounds like you're recruiting and supporting good candidates to run in some of these strategic locations. So how do you figure out, we have the need so much, all over the country. How do you figure out strategically which areas you're going to be looking at candidates?
Mm-hmm. Well, it all starts with the election calendar, and this is one of the things that is a bit of a challenge from a political landscape. There are elections that are happening all the time. They don't just happen in November. We just had an election on Thursday for the city council for Vermont. We've had special elections. We've heard all about some of the larger congressional special elections, but there's also been a bunch of special elections in the Georgia House Senate and the Tennessee House of Delegates, and South Carolina had a special congressional race. So there are elections that happen literally every week. We just sat down with the calendar a couple of weeks ago, and there are folks running for office everywhere all the time. So what we do is we really watch the election calendar. We diagnose the political situation in whatever geographic region. So, for example, we're keeping our eye on the school board races in Alabama. So as the time gets closer to school board races in Alabama, we'll start reaching out to partners and start doing maybe some email requests and some conversations with folks that train and recruit pro-choice candidates, particularly women in Alabama, and we'll ask if they've had any great candidates who are running for school boards, and then we'll help them. So this is where we're really looking at it both from a temporal, like a calendar perspective, as well as a partnership perspective. And while we don't necessarily recruit candidates so much, we are in communication with who is on the field, and we're making constant connections with organizations like Vote Run Lead, Emerge America, Run for Something, all the Working Families Party, all the organizations that train and recruit candidates. We're in communication with them, so we're able to support these great candidates. On the partnership note, I will say that we as Vote Pro Choice, and I would also like to commit and reiterate to your listeners how important practical political action really is, that we try not to reinvent the wheel. We're all about partnership. And I think that I would hope that we as a movement start really focusing on how we can work together better, sharing information, being in collaboration. So, for example, with Vote Pro Choice in Virginia, we stay in communication with other organizations and folks working in Virginia, and we will support candidates that may or may not get attention from other organizations. But if Planned Parenthood is supporting a particular slate of candidates, we will do the same and be of service where we can. And I think that I would hope all the folks out there who are engaged in political action would also take that perspective as well.
Yeah, that's great. And I know we've got, for example, Emily's List out there, which has been Democratic pro-choice women.
Oh, yes, I should have mentioned Emily's List. They're wonderful. Yes.
Yeah, running. And they started to go a little bit down into some of the state races also, but they still have kept a very strong focus on Congress. So that's great that you're communicating and collaborating with that range of existing organizations.
Yes, we absolutely have to. That's really where we have to be honest about the fact that if we know that American voters are actually pro-choice, but we have not actually been implementing a pro-choice agenda, we haven't been acting like a pro-choice nation, that there is a gap there. And that means that there are more voters and more folks out there that need to be brought into the movement and engaged politically in different ways.
Well, exactly.
So
and we can start with voting. It just amazes me sometimes about the number of educated, even active women who are not registered to vote, or if they are registered to vote, they don't bother to vote because they're busy or they don't think their vote matters. And I would hope this last election just blew that myth out of the water. You know, it is just so critical for everybody to register and to vote at a bare minimum and hopefully get involved in a local race where you're supporting a good candidate as a volunteer or making a donation, or really we've all got to put our shoulder to the wheel to reclaim our democracy here.
That's correct. We are seeing a lot of hopeful engagement. We saw it in the Georgia 6th congressional race, lots of folks coming out to vote. And you hit on a very critical point, which is people don't vote because they don't think their vote matters. And I'm very, very hopeful that that will change, as you said. We hope to tell the story. We hope to elevate that story through our partnerships, through our platform, through the communications that we have out into the world, where we see, again, I'll go back to the Virginia delegates race that we just finished, where Jennifer Carroll Foy won by 12 votes. She is a powerful, progressive woman of color who will be a pro-choice champion in the Virginia State House race. And we hope that this was a first election for her, but I am certain it will not be the last. Similarly, you know, to my own political mentor, Kamala Harris, she started as a district attorney, 8 points behind the incumbent that she took on, and we just all got behind her. We got her elected, and it was, now she's in the U.S. Senate as a major champion. So that's what it takes. Sadly, this work is not glamorous. It's a little bit like, as I always say, digging a swimming pool with a garden spade. But in a lot of ways, we have to think of it as, we have to re-net the fabric of democracy now. Uh-huh. We have to restart. We have to build at the foundation. We have seen all the things that we've lost. And I really do think it's important for us to get practical and focused and look down ballot. And I will also say on this issue of the work that we're doing that is through the lens of a pro-choice reproductive health care access lens, we do believe at Vote Pro-Choice that this issue of reproductive health access to abortion and birth control, it is a very foundational issue. It is not a single issue. It gives you a very broad lens of the candidates and the leaders that you're supporting, that it is as foundational as your perspective on climate change and economic policy. And one of the things that was very eye-opening for me is when we were doing focus groups of white pro-choice women in swing states who had voted for Trump. Their first response of, why did you do that? You know, you are a pro-choice woman. Why did you vote for Trump? They said, we don't vote on that issue. We vote on the economy. And we didn't believe that he was actually as anti-choice as he was. That was the other thing that was kind of interesting, but we can talk about that in a second. And that what that triggered for me is that we as a movement haven't really been talking about this issue correctly. And we're seeing that with the current conversation with the Democratic Party and how do we deal with abortion and anti-choice Democrats who might want the support of the party and what should the party do. We do believe that access to birth control, reproductive health care services, and abortion is a foundational economic issue, that without these ubiquitous, safe, legal access to these services, half of the planet, women, don't have a shot and can't contribute into the economy in a productive way that is that is aligned with the freedom and the inalienable rights that we say that we stand for as a country. So for us, this is a reframing of what it means to be pro-choice in a very broad and foundational way. And I really do hope that we can start talking about it in that way.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it has kind of gotten narrowed down quite a bit. But it truly is, it's an issue of both of our economic ability and our sovereignty, our individual freedom. And, you know, talk to any woman who needed an abortion and could not get one, had a child, now they're raising a child they didn't really want for that 18 to 20 years, and just the limits that puts on your ability to work and the drain it is on your pocketbook trying to find and pay for child care. And, you know, they say it costs like $1 million to raise a child now. So
wow.
It's just really, mm-hmm. it has profound economic impact on women and anyone connected to them and on the children that they're trying to raise. So mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear you kind of widening the lens on that. There is a debate, as you just referenced there, in the Democratic Party about whether to stay strongly pro-choice. And there are people saying, including Nancy Pelosi, the leader and minority leader in the U.S. House, recently said that maybe the Democratic Party should have more of a big tent and allow people to vote on, or, you know, think about the abortion issue however they wanted, but that the Democratic Party would welcome anti-choice people as well, as long as they agreed with the economic platform and other issues. What would you say to Nancy Pelosi and to those who are making the argument that the Democratic Party should back off of its commitment to choice?
Well, under no circumstances do I believe that the Democratic Party should back off on its position, on its platform. The platform of the Democratic Party is actually a very powerful, expansive, open, inclusive platform of reproductive health care access, sex ed, health of women, health of transgender people. So it's actually a really great piece of policy, and I think we really need to stick with it, including the message has to be, guess what? 7 in 10 American voters believe a woman should have access to reproductive health care services. It is a winning strategy, and we really must agree not to even use the term big tent anymore, because uh-huh. It's a win to be able to engage pro-choice voters. And let me tell you, like, my perspective is actually that these anti-choice Democrats have been losing their races, by the way. Hmm. And so perhaps we need to look at it in a different way. Mm-hmm. Folks that aren't really pro-choice, women are not voting for them. And so mm-hmm. let's look at that. This is not mm-hmm. about making a big tent. It's about actually finding candidates and holding them accountable to freedom for mm-hmm. all of the citizens and voters. So, however, as a San Franciscan, I do, I will give, I am a San Francisco, it's true. I believe that Nancy Pelosi is representing a community that is adamantly pro-choice. And I do believe that her perspective, she was reflecting the perspective of her voters, which if you look at what she actually said, she was talking about it, it's not an issue as much anymore. And if you look broadly across the Democratic Party candidates, this issue of anti-choice Democrats, there aren't actually that many of them. And so mm-hmm. we've gotten really confused about what this debate really is about. And I want to, again, go back to what we talked about before, which is we are letting a vocal minority control this narrative, and we're forgetting the reality of this position and this policy. 70% of American voters are pro-choice. 89% of New Yorkers believe a woman should have access to abortion rights, you know, or abortion mm-hmm. services. It's like we've got to focus on glasses full, pretty much all the way full, not even half full. So yeah. Let's really focus on that.
And as you say, the whole issue of reproductive rights is totally connected to economic issues, so that you can't really separate that out. I wanted to talk to you about women's leadership here, and I think when you're doing your work on getting the pro-choice candidates and supporting them, I assume you're supporting men as well as women if the men are pro-reproductive rights? Yeah, that's great.
But we do give a little extra yes and help to our pro-choice women candidates and women of color. And I'll tell you why. There's two reasons why. And it actually is related directly to access to reproductive health care services. One of the things that I believe across the board, if we look at what foundational solutions are to our society's most intractable problems, it's making sure that in places of power and decision-making, authority and policy, we have diverse perspectives. And a foundation of diversity in America, particularly in government and politics, is making sure that there are women at the table, and as well as men, people of color, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, coming together to decide policy and issues that impact other people. So in order for women to elevate in positions of leadership, they do have to have control over their reproductive health, period. So in order for women to run for office, they also have to be able to plan their families or decide what works for them so they can serve in the way that they want to serve. So that is actually one of the challenges, I think, of women running for office. You know, democracy was invented in 5th century BC by men in power who wanted to alienate women and slaves and people who didn't own land. And in a lot of ways, it really hasn't changed in thousands of years. So what we see now is a transformation of a deep and embedded system that is not structured for the reality of the way that women live their lives. They're the ones that are having the babies and making sure that the human race is continuing to be on the earth, as well as we know all of the disparity, the pay equity disparity, the amount of women generally have to take on more household duties, all of the things that we know about how women are not as able to be as like economically free in society as men. So there is a challenge for women to step into political leadership because of the nature of the political structure itself. You have to be present. You have to show up to all these random events all the time to get known. You have to be out there shaking hands with voters. You have to raise a lot of money. And you almost start from a disadvantage from thousands of years ago. And so that's why it's really important to just focus on these, on diverse perspectives, diverse voices, to elevate them into positions of leadership. And it just takes something as simple as a endorsement or a candidate support or a little extra money or a little extra technical support. it really does change the world in a profound way, and it changes the world for all of us and makes society a better place, makes America a better place, and hopefully we'll save democracy as we know it. That's my hope.
Yeah, that's a good hope, and you got a plan to do it, which I appreciate. And I'm thrilled that we've got a huge surge now in women agreeing to run at, you know, local, state, and federal offices. Emily's List says they've had over 12,000 women wanting to call and get information about how to run for office. So I think women are stepping up to the table to try to help save America. And just really briefly, like in 30 seconds, what can our listeners do and how can they find out more about what you're doing?
Well, I'm biased toward Vote Pro Choice, so please go to voteprochoice.us and sign up. And that means that you'll get information about our candidates that we're endorsing and ways that you can support them. Additionally, that means you'll also receive the ballot guide for 2017, so you'll know who to vote for all the way down ballot. But I also want to encourage folks to run for office at the localist levels. Please and volunteer for your PTAs, get involved in community leadership. And secondly, please, please, please do a little bit of Google research on what's going on in your state legislatures, particularly with regard to reproductive health access. Know what's going on, what the status is in your state. The National Institute for Reproductive Health has some great information, as well as your Planned Parenthoods and NARALs. Be informed, and I will warn you, once you get informed, you're going to be a little horrified. So we're hoping that you'll be able to ignite it and step into leadership, and that you'll definitely vote for choice in the next elections.
Fantastic. And that website, again, is voteprochoice.us, and I encourage our listeners to tune in and sign up and get engaged. That's all the time we have. Heidi Sayak, thank you so very much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Thank you so much.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.